Oh, what a good help me.
She knows how to.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
Okay. Last week, okay, we finished with Abimelech, and then went on to two other. I'm not sure if you could really classify them as judges or governors of their time. We were given very little information about them, except for the fact that apparently in certain areas there was peace for a number of years. Let me see if I can find that. Yeah, there was Tola. All right, he judged Israel. Well, Scripture says he judged, so I guess he is a judge. Judged Israel 23 years. And Jair also judged Israel 22 years. So you've got a period there of these two judges, which we're not told a lot about. But it would appear that there was some sort of peace in the land. But verse 6 takes a different turn and a different tone. And we read this last week, but it's good to read it again to understand what's happening here. Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. Served the Baals.
What chapter?
Chapter 10, verse 6. And the Ashtaroth, the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the sons of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines, thus they forsook the Lord and did not serve him. So now we have a pretty long list here of all of the different gods in the land of Canaan that the Israelites were bowing down to. And verse 7 says, and the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the sons of Ammon. As Pastor had explained, he put them in a kind of a pincer movement, okay? He had the Philistines on the west coast by the water, okay, coming into Canaan, and he had the Ammonites on the other side, on the east of the Jordan, putting pressure on. And they afflicted and crushed the sons of Israel that year. So we don't know how long the Philistines were involved, okay? But the next group, for 18 years they afflicted all the sons of Israel who were beyond the Jordan in Gilead in the land of the Amorites. So those that were east of the Jordan River, remember those 2.5 tribes that originally had been allocated that land, okay? Gad, Reuben, and a half tribe of Manasseh. They're under pressure from this group called the Amorites. And the sons of Ammon crossed the Jordan to fight also against Judah, Benjamin, and the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was greatly distressed. These Ammonites, or sons of Ammon, okay, they're looking to extend their borders. They want more land. Understand the history of what's happening there. A lot of different groups and nations are vying for power and want to grow. They want to grow, okay, and they see what's happening. So they're trying to establish themselves and get land. Then the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord, saying, we have sinned against thee, for indeed we have forsaken our God and served the Baals. Now, for the first time in Judges, we get the sons of Israel saying, we have sinned against thee. They've never said that before. They haven't repented. They've never said that before. What they had always done was cry out to God for help from their enemies, and God would raise up a deliverer. It's going to be a little bit of a change here, though, okay? Here now, the sons of Israel cry to the Lord, saying, we have sinned against thee. They don't really ask for forgiveness, nor do they indicate any kind of repentance. They do acknowledge that they have sinned against thee. And this is the first and only time in the book of Judges that they say this. Verse 11 says, and the Lord said to the sons of Israel, did I not deliver you from the Egyptians, the Amorites, the sons of Ammon, and the Philistines? Also when the Sidonians and the Amalekites and the Maonites are a new name. We haven't heard about them. Are they Midianites? Was a mistake made in transcribing? I don't know. but it may have been a smaller tribe living in that area, this group of Maonites. When they oppressed you, you cried out to me, and I delivered you from their hands. Yet you have forsaken me and served other gods. Therefore, I will deliver you no more. And now, we don't know how God is speaking to the people, whether it's through a prophet, whether his voice is being spoken to elders. We don't know how he's communicating, but obviously he's communicating. And he says to them now, I will deliver you no more. And sarcastically, in verse 14, he says, go and cry out to the gods which you have chosen. Let them deliver you in the time of your distress. And the sons of Israel said to the Lord, their reply now is, we have sinned. Do to us whatever seems good to thee. Excuse me. Now, that would be fine if they left it there. But only please deliver us this day. Okay? So in other words, do whatever you think is good, what is just and right in your eyes, but deliver us this day from this oppression that we're under. Again, half-baked, okay? We have sinned. Do to us whatever seems good to thee. Well, here's what God... Well, verse 16. So they put away the foreign gods from among them and served the Lord. That sounds good, okay? How did they serve the Lord? Well, they probably were sacrificing and set up some altars and went through that routine. But it says, and he could bear the misery of Israel no longer. Now, for years, that was always interpreted that God couldn't stand what was happening to the Israelites, okay, and that he was going to do something about it. However, upon further study of the words where they get that sentence, he could bear the misery of Israel no longer, really means his soul was short. That's what the Hebrew words mean. His soul was short. And that means he was exasperated, okay? He was angry, and he was finished in raising up deliverers for the people. Yeah, it means his soul was short. That's the interpretation. So this is not an indication that he is going to help them. It's an indication that he is basically saying, you have finally put yourselves into this position. Remember what they said, do to us what is just and good. Understand that through Judges, God did something different. He never did what was just and right as far as the people were concerned, because if he did, he would have annihilated them. He went to grace instead. He went to grace. You know, pastors often said, so many people say the New Testament is the New Testament of grace. But grace has been, since God has been working, grace has been evident. And here is where real grace has been evident, in the fact that he would raise up deliverers for people who constantly turned their backs on him and worshipped other gods. So he wasn't being just and right the way real justice should be. He was showing his grace. But now he is saying, look, you've made your... This is what he's saying. You've made your own bed. Now go sleep in it. Now go sleep in it. Let's see what happens now. Okay. Then the sons of Ammon were summoned, and they camped in Gilead. Gilead is an area within the tribe of Gad, on the east side of the Jordan. And the sons of Israel gathered together and camped in Mizpah. Now, this is not the same Mizpah that will be mentioned in the future. We're not sure where it is, okay? We're not even sure what it is. Is it just some kind of an altar or something? But they're at this place, Mizpah. So you have now two armies. And the people, the leaders of Gilead, said to one another, who is the man who will begin to fight against the sons of Ammon? He shall become head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. Now remember that sentence, because something interesting is going to take place here. He shall become head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. So in their desperation now, notice God is not raising up a deliverer. The people are looking for a deliverer. And the people make an offer here, okay? Human nature make an offer. If you will lead us in the fight against Ammon and defeat them, we will make you head over this whole area. Not all of what we know as Israel, but certainly that major portion in the Transjordan. So, chapter 11, verse 1. Now Jephthah, the Gileadite, was a valiant warrior, but he was the son of a harlot, and Gilead was the father of Jephthah. Now we're going to see striking similarities here between Jephthah and Abimelech. Remember Abimelech's mother was a concubine that lived in Shechem, okay, and remember what happened to him when the Gideon passed away, the brothers kicked him out, okay, because they didn't want him to share in the inheritance, because basically in their minds he was what they would call a half-breed, okay? He wasn't full. Well, now we have, but at least Gideon's concubine was, she had a title, okay, as a concubine. She was like a secondary wife. She had something, okay? Now we're going to go down even lower, okay? He's a valiant warrior, but he was the son of a harlot. That means she was a prostitute. We're not even told if she was an Israelite or if she was a Canaanite. But this begs a lot of questions. What is Gilead? And as I said, that's the name of an area. It can be the name of a town, but it also can be the name of a clan and the name of the clan's leader, which probably is Gilead. Gilead was the father of Jephthah. Okay, what is he doing, an Israelite, going to a prostitute? What God is showing us here is how far they have sunk. Okay, remember all of the laws that they were given? Remember what they were told that they could do and not do? Well, certainly for an Israelite to go to a prostitute, and he's married, why is he doing that? Was forbidden. And what makes it worse here, let's suppose she was a Canaanite, and let's suppose she was a prostitute for one of the Canaanite fertility cults. That makes it even worse that an Israelite is going to that, to a Canaanite cult, okay, and have relations with this woman. So, this Jephthah is born. He's a valiant warrior, but he is the son of a prostitute. Verse 2 says, and Gilead's wife bore him sons. Now this is his wife, okay? Bore him sons. And when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, you shall not have an inheritance in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman. Very similar to Abimelech, but even worse in the fact that she was a prostitute. So apparently Gilead was getting ready to pass away here, and the sons, okay, drive him out, drive Jephthah out, because they don't want him to have any share in the inheritance. So, verse 3 says, Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob. I don't know where that is, probably somewhere in the outskirts of Gilead, mountainous areas or whatever. But he lived in the land of Tob, and worthless fellows gathered themselves about Jephthah, and they went out with him. He becomes a bandit. Okay? He and this group of men. He obviously is a leader, and they follow him. And Jephthah, okay, according to history, has no qualms about raiding his own people in Gilead, raiding anybody that he thought he could get away with it. He becomes basically a bandit, okay, a robber. That's how he and his men sustain themselves. They don't care who they attack as long as they believe they can get away with it. And he is a warrior. So verse 4 says, and it came about after a while that the sons of Ammon fought against Israel. And it happened when the sons of Ammon fought against Israel that the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land of Tob. Notice, God is not, does not seem to be involved in any of this. It's always been God who has raised the deliverer up, but not in this case. It's the people that are raising the deliverer up. And they said to Jephthah, "Come and be our chief, that we may fight against the sons of Ammon." Now there's a difference here. Notice what they originally said, that the person that led them to victory would become head over all the inhabitants. Now they've changed that a little bit with Jephthah because they know who he is. Okay, he's a bandit. So what they're offering him is to be chief. In other words, commander of the army, but no further than that. Mm-hmm. Jephthah's an amazing person, really, because he like Gideon, he has diplomatic style and flair to him, okay? He's pretty good at negotiations for a guy who's been abandoned in the hills, okay? Look at verse 7. "Then Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, 'Did you not hate me and drive me from my father's house? So why have you come to me now when you are in trouble?' And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, 'For this reason we have now returned to you, that you may go with us and fight with the sons of Ammon and become head,'" now they say, "become head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." See, when they first said, "Be our chief," okay, Jephthah replies with, "What do you want from me? Okay, why have you come to me?" Now they up the offer a little bit. Okay, "Now you can become head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." So Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "If you take me back to fight against the sons of Ammon, and the Lord gives them up to me, will I become your head?" Again, he questions them. He's not finished with his negotiations. He shows a little sign of, I don't know what you want to call it, when he brings God into the picture, okay? But he brings God into the picture, but you know that it's only going to be half-hearted, okay? You would classify Jephthah as this type, as a practical Yahwist. And when I say a practical Yahwist, what I mean is, okay, he would bring up the name of Yahweh when he wanted to, but he wouldn't listen to Yahweh had he had a relationship with Yahweh, which he didn't. But being a practical Yahwist, like many people today are practical Christians, they call on the name of Jesus, but they really are not living that life and really don't have a relationship with Jesus. But he never, okay, would miss the opportunity to try to manipulate God. Now, how many Christians today try to manipulate God? So in a way, this is a little bit of manipulation he's beginning, but it is negotiations with the elders of Gilead. So, piously, he says, "If the Lord gives them up to me, will I become your head?" And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, "The Lord is witness between us. Surely we will do as you have said." But God, obviously God knows what's going on, but he's not involved in this, okay? So here we have two parties talking about God when they haven't even worshipped God, okay? So they say, "The Lord is witness between us. Surely we will do as you have said." Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and chief over them. And Jephthah spoke all his words before the Lord at Mizpah. So they have a ceremony at Mizpah, and he's speaking out, and they're using the name of the Lord as a confirmation of this whole thing. Now Jephthah sent messengers to the king of the sons of Ammon, saying, "What is between you and me that you have come to me to fight against my land?" Now it's become his land. Notice how quickly into leadership role is his land. It's obvious that he would prefer to negotiate a peaceful settlement. Here's the problem with Ammon. Ammon is making claims to land here. They're going to make claims to land that they had never, ever occupied. What they are doing basically is rewriting, revising history to suit their needs, and their needs at this time is more land, extending borders out, okay, to make themselves look like a power. But they were never in that area. Okay. And the king of the sons of Ammon said to the messengers of Jephthah, because Israel took away my land when they came up from Egypt, from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok and the Jordan, therefore return them peaceably now. Give us the land back that you took from us. But it's land that they never had. It's land they never had. It's like the Palestinians today, claiming land that they never really had. Rewriting history. So, Jephthah, he's a pretty smart guy. I don't know where he gets his smarts from or where he remembers the history of Israel from. But Jephthah sent messengers again to the king of the sons of Ammon. And they said to him, thus says Jephthah, Israel did not take away the land of Moab, nor the land of the sons of Ammon. For when they came up from Egypt, and Israel went through the wilderness to the Red Sea and came to Kadesh, then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying, please let us pass through your land. But the king of Edom would not listen. And they also sent to the king of Moab, but he would not consent. So Israel remained at Kadesh. Then they went through the wilderness and around the land of Edom and the land of Moab, and came to the east side of the land of Moab, and they camped beyond the Arnon. But they did not enter the territory of Moab, for the Arnon was the border of Moab. And Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, the king of Heshbon. And Israel said to him, please let us pass through your land to our place. But Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through his territory. So Sihon gathered all his people and camped in Jahaz and fought with Israel. And the Lord, the God of Israel, gave Sihon and all his people into the hand of Israel, and they defeated them. So Israel possessed all the land of the Amorites, the inhabitants of that country. So they possessed all the territory of the Amorites from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok and from the wilderness as far as the Jordan. But see, these were Amorites, not Ammonites. Since now the Lord, the God of Israel, drove out the Amorites from before his people Israel, are you then to possess it? Do you not possess what Chemosh your God gives to you to possess? So whatever the Lord our God has driven out before us, we will possess it. Now, so far he is correct in his history, okay? He has added a few things. Here, I don't know whether he makes a mistake or it's an intentional slur at the Ammonites, okay? But do you not possess what Chemosh? Chemosh was not their God. Chemosh was the God of Moab. The God of Moab, okay? And so there is a difference there. So whatever the Lord our God has driven out before us, we'll possess it. And now are you any better than Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever strive with Israel, or did he ever fight against them? While Israel lived in Heshbon and its villages, and in Aroer and its villages, and in all the cities that are on the banks of the Arnon 300 years, why did you not recover them within that time? So now he says, you know, those 300 years, where have you been? All of a sudden now you're saying, this is your land. Why didn't you take it then, if it was your land? So he says, I therefore have not sinned against you, but you are doing me wrong by making war against me. May the Lord, the judge today between the sons of Israel and the sons of Ammon. Again, he brings God's name into the picture here. And yet, he has no relationship with God, nor do the people. You know that they're synchristic in nature. Yes, they know of Yahweh, okay, but they are also continually worshiping other gods. And God has pulled away and is allowing human nature to run its course here. Go ahead.
So, could it have been that even though by him being born the way he, you know, mm-hmm. as the son of a harlot, but it was kind of like with Abraham's son that he had with the concubine, and it, you know, he was driven into the wilderness as well.
Ishmael.
Yeah, Ishmael. But the Lord kept his hand on him.
Mm-hmm.
And even though when he keeps his hand on you and he's talking and working in your life, just because you continue to do the way you do because you feel that it was unjust the way you were driven out. And I just kind of start to think like, well, perhaps he did know God, but he didn't want to follow him after.
Oh, I'm sure that he was aware of him, obviously.
Because it's kind of interesting the way it's almost like he gets chastised later with that whole ordeal by making promises that he shouldn't.
Oh, well, there's no question about that. And there again, that brings up interesting questions if we get to it. Here is where it would seem now that God does step back into the picture. Not that he's ever been out of the picture, but he has been allowing human nature to run its course. And I have to believe that God works that way.
Right.
Allows human nature to run its course until perhaps he deems it necessary to step in so that his will and purpose is going to be accomplished on this earth. So, you know, that part of it is interesting. Now, verse 28 says, but the king of the sons of Ammon disregarded the message which Jephthah sent him. Now, verse 29, now the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, so that he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, then he passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he went on to the sons of Ammon. Now, Shalia, whether he was aware that the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, I don't know.
That's
questionable.
I think that all along he had been dwelling with the Spirit of the Lord, and that's how he had been protected as he was abandoned out there and doing all the things, because God had, you know, as to say, he had saved him for such a time as this. And so this is where he's going to teach him.
Well, I see, but the part...
Do you think if he knew the Spirit of the Lord had come upon him, he would have made the vow?
I think that's very questionable if he understands the Spirit of the Lord is going to give him power. And the power that he's given here, notice where he goes. What is he doing? He passed through Gilead and Manasseh. That's up above, okay? That's the half tribe. Then he passed through Mizpah of Gilead. And from Mizpah of Gilead, he went on to the sons of Ammon. What he is doing here is raising troops.
Right.
He's going through that whole area. And the Spirit of God now is moving.
Mm-hmm.
And having people respond to him to help. But that's a good question.
Because that's so much like Christians today. There are so many Christians today that are powerful in what they do, but they're so encamped in their own ideas,
right,
that they miss what God is doing.
Right.
And so I kind of look at Jephthah very similar to that, because as I read this, you know, you read many years ago, and then you come back and you keep reading and trying to figure out what is it about him that he did not recognize what he had, the strength and the power that he had as a warrior.
He, you know what, you touched upon a very important point here. Jephthah could have been one of the greatest figures in the history of Israel had he kept his eyes focused on God.
Amen.
But he didn't. His eyes were focused on himself, and always himself. So we go back. Did God has pulled away from the people? I mean, that's clear here what he has said, and he's letting human nature take its course. Of course, he knows what's happening and what's going to happen, and now he is going to intervene, okay, and the Spirit is going to come upon Jephthah so that he can get people to follow him, raise up this army, and then he's going to fight. Now here is where this guy knows how to talk.
Didn't he do that? I kind of have to go, but didn't he do that with Saul? Remember?
Yeah. I mean, he knows how. Here is a guy who's he knows how to negotiate. He knows what to speak. He knows how to talk. Look at what he does now. And Jephthah, verse 30, and Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, if thou wilt indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering.
Mm.
Now, why would he say something like that? I can only believe that that's the Canaanized part of his heart speaking here, okay? And his selfishness What's going to come out of his house? Does he expect an animal to come out of his house? Maybe.
See, he expects that's what's going to run into the courtyard, but it's his daughter.
Yeah.
See, it's the same thing we do. We make these vows. That's why he says, nothing is ours to make as a vow.
Right.
So you should
don't make vows. And so he makes this incredible vow, and I'd have to believe that he's making this type of a vow because of what he has seen the Canaanites do, okay, and Moab do in particularly by offering children to their God and sacrificing their own child. And so do you think that God, our God, would be pleased with the offering of a child to him when he strictly said that was an abomination, that you should never, ever even think about doing something like that? He makes this vow. So Jephthah crossed over to the sons of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand. And he struck them with a very great slaughter, from Aurora to the entrance of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abel Kararim. So the sons of Ammon were subdued before the sons of Israel. Now, he did not go deep into Ammon, okay, and try to take their territory, but he subdued all of the outskirts. He extended the borders, took away their outposts, their lookouts, and the areas that they were trying to come into. He wiped them out. When Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, behold, his daughter was coming out to meet him with tambourines and with dancing. Of course, she's elated to see him coming, okay? Obviously, from what she would see as he's approaching, he was successful in his fight. And so she's coming out. This is her father. She's coming out in innocence to welcome him. Now, she was his one and only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. And it came about when he saw her that he tore his clothes and said, again, this language, look who he's looking at. He's not looking so much at his daughter. Remember the status of women back then. They didn't have any. They were thought to be second-class citizens when it came to men. Look what he says to her. Okay? He tore his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low." Me! You brought me very low. It's she that's in danger. "You have brought me very low, and you are among those who trouble me." What kind of a thing is that to say to his daughter, his only daughter? "For I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot take it back." I don't know why not. In his case, I don't know why not. It's not like he's been faithful. It's not like he has a relationship with Yahweh. This is an innocent child, and look what she says. So she said to him, "My father, you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me as you have said, since the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the sons of Ammon." And she said to her father, "Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months, that I may go to the mountains and weep because of my virginity, I and my companions." When she says weep because of my virginity, does not mean that she would miss out on having relations with a man. She would miss out on the opportunity to bear children. And that was the woman's primary thing in that day, was to bear children. That's where they got their status and their strength from, was in bearing children. So she is saying, "I'm never going to be able to have children. So let me go with my friends, okay, my companions." Then he said, "Go." So he sent her away for 2 months. And she left with her companions and wept on the mountains because of her virginity. You know, Jephthah doesn't understand something here. And we could look at Abraham and Isaac. God said to Abraham, okay, you're going to sacrifice Isaac. And Abraham is faithful, okay, and follows God's instructions. And because of that, God blesses Abraham, saves Isaac, and takes care of the promises that he has made to Abraham. Here we have the reverse, okay? Here we have Jephthah doesn't understand. This is his only daughter. By killing his only daughter, which he has taken a vow to do, he wipes out his seed, his lineage. There will be nothing to follow. Nothing to follow Jephthah. There'll be nothing. So in essence, he's killing himself at the same time. It's a remarkable set of circumstances that we have here.
Well, I don't understand why God didn't intervene and not let it happen.
Well, that's a good question.
Well, there's two thoughts. One was that she wasn't actually slain. It was that she never could bear children.
He had her committed to like a monastery type thing and all of that. He sacrificed her.
He did.
He sacrificed her.
When she returned to her father, he did to her as he vowed.
Right. And that's exactly what took place. Why didn't God step in? Well, why should God step in? Jephthah made a vow that he should not have made. Okay? And he is... Again, we have to understand these people, okay? They are so Canaanized in their ways, they are still thinking that way, that he's letting them do what they're going to do, and he's not going to intervene. He's not going to intervene. There are so many cases throughout the Old Testament where we would say, why didn't God intervene? When Abimelech killed those 69 kids, okay, why didn't God intervene and stop that? Because that's human nature, and God allows human nature to take its course. So, she understands, apparently, in her innocence.
Yeah, I wouldn't return. I'd stay in those hells.
There is more here, though, with the treatment of a man and his daughter. I mean, we're basically looking at child abuse. We're looking at an example of everything that a father should not be. But his first comment was that he was brought low. Not what's going to happen to his daughter. You don't really see any love there. So he allows her to go, and she goes with her companions. Verse 39 says, "And it came about at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father, who did to her according to the vow which he had made. And she had no relations with a man, thus became a custom in Israel, that the daughters of Israel went yearly to commemorate the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadite, 4 days in the year." Now, actually, that took place. Now, it wasn't a national holiday. Here's the thing. Jephthah was never, outside of what we have in Scripture here, as far as Israel went, Jephthah was never really remembered. But this innocent child that we don't even have a name for was remembered. And at least that area of Gilead, the women, 4 days of the year, would celebrate her and what happened to her. All right, chapter 12. And here we go again with Ephraim. "Then the men of Ephraim were summoned, and they crossed to Zaphon, and said to Jephthah, 'Why did you cross over to fight against the sons of Ammon without calling us to go with you? We will burn your house down on you.'" Remember what they did with Gideon, the same thing, okay, when Gideon fought the fight and was winning, okay. They went to Gideon and they said, "You know, we have a contention with you. Why did you not call us? Well, Gideon, being the diplomat that he is, he smoothed things over and he allowed Ephraim basically to do the mop-up work as far as other, when they went further after the enemies of Israel. Here again, Ephraim, okay, they were this is an egotistical, boastful, big-mouth tribe of men. Because every time they shoot their mouth off, okay, they either are pacified by what the other individual offers them, or when they did get into a fight, they fought very poorly. And yet, this is who they think they are. And so they go in, but this is another classic case of the fragmentation of the tribes of Israel. You have a Transjordan tribe, and you have the other side of the Jordan, okay, the Canaan, Ephraim, you have that tribe. And there was hostilities between them. Not only was Israel broken up and worshiping a whole bunch of different gods, okay, they also were going against one another. So here they come. Why did you cross over to fight against the sons of Ammon without calling us to go with you? We will burn your house down. And Jephthah said to them, I and my people were at great strife with the sons of Ammon when I called you. Now we don't know whether he in fact did call. We know the area he went in wasn't by Ephraim when he was summoning up all the troops, when the Holy Spirit of God was working with him. You did not deliver me from their hand. And when I saw that you would not deliver me, I took my life in my hands and crossed over against the sons of Ammon, and the Lord gave them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me? Then Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead and fought Ephraim. Unlike Gideon, okay, he doesn't try to smooth things over, okay, he merely states the facts, and he is willing to fight. But he's fighting his brothers. Jephthah is a possessed man as far as the fact that he is looking out for himself, and he has no care about other people, okay? He certainly had no care about his daughter. He has no care about other brothers of Israel. He gathers his men and fought Ephraim. And the men of Gilead defeated Ephraim because they said, you are fugitives of Ephraim, O Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and in the midst of Manasseh. And the Gileadites captured the lords of the Jordan opposite Ephraim. And it happened when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, let me cross over, the men of Gilead would say to him, are you an Ephraimite? If he said no, then they would say to him, say now, Shibboleth. But he said, Sibboleth, for he could not pronounce it correctly. Now, you know, we're laughing, but let me show you, this is so sad. These Ephraimites, okay, could not even speak Hebrew correctly.
Kind of like the difference between idea and idea.
Yeah.
Coffee,
tomato and tomato, that's kind of the same. But here, this is an inability to speak Hebrew, which they should have had. He could not pronounce it correctly. Then they seized him and slew him at the fords of the Jordan. Thus there fell at that time 42,000 of Ephraim. Now,
just because he couldn't pronounce it right?
Yeah.
It doesn't sound very nice.
Nice. See, we had a fight, and Ephraim was scattered, and now trying to return home, okay, the Gileadites took up positions along the Jordan, and apparently it's then that 42,000 fall. He killed 42,000 of his brothers.
And the ones that were just trying to escape from the battle.
I,
he because he said the ones that were escaping and trying to cross the Jordan.
Well, that could be.
There's probably even more that got killed that they don't tell us about here.
Where is God?
Watching.
Yeah. He is watching. But he's allowing it to take place. But all of, remember what he said, I am fed up with you people. And so now, rather than putting his grace on them, he did against the Ammonites, because God had a thing against the Ammonites, there's no question about that. But as far as his own people went, he had pulled back from them. Jephthah judged Israel 6 years, then Jephthah the Gileadite died and was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. And so we have this amazing story of someone who could have been one of the greatest leaders and judges at this time in Israel, but he was thinking only of himself. Only of himself and his power and what he wanted. Never really turning to God. Using God's name when it suited him, but always more attempting to manipulate God to do what he wanted. The vow. Would you call that manipulation? Stupid manipulation. But nevertheless, an attempt at manipulating God. Now, Ibzan's judgeship. Now, Ibzan of Bethlehem judged Israel after him. And he had 30 sons and 30 daughters, whom he gave in marriage outside the family. And he brought in 30 daughters from outside for his sons. And he judged Israel 7 years. Then Ibzan died and was buried in Bethlehem. Then we have another judge, Elon. Now Elon, the Zebulunite, judged Israel after him, and he judged Israel 10 years. Then Elon, the Zebulunite, died and was buried at Aijalon in the land of Zebulun.
Again, isn't it terrible they don't give anything?
We're not given a lot of
that they had this big family.
They weren't very important.
Then we get another judge, Abdon. Now Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, judged Israel after him. And he had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 donkeys. And he judged Israel 8 years. Then Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, died and was buried at Pirathon in the land of Ephraim, in the hill country of the Amalekites.
God appointed these judges? But we don't know.
Yeah. I'm guessing he did. I don't know. If you want to call them minor judges because we don't have information on them, maybe. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I don't know. But I know that he didn't raise Jephthah as a deliverer. The people went to him, but he did empower Jephthah at a certain time. But Jephthah, I guess he was a lot like Abimelech, okay? He wanted for himself and for himself only. But surely that this thing with his daughter, I know, runs deeper than what we're able to take out of it.
So he did know about all the gods. It does say that he was so familiar with the Canaanite practices and he embraced those.
Oh yeah, he did.
He was such an old
baby. See, what we're looking at here at this point in time is basically the full canonization of the nation of Israel. the very thing that God warned them and warned them and warned them about. But they go ahead and they fall prey to this. And so we have times where God has bestowed his grace on them when he would raise up deliverers. And we had a case here where while the Holy Spirit became involved, I mean, God basically had pulled out of this situation. And particularly when he had his people killing themselves, brothers killing brothers, that's being just and right. That's when God is just and right in his judgment. In the last time when judgment falls, God will be just and right in the judgment that he puts on people. Unbelievers will have no defense, no excuse, and they will know.
I just want to say something in my NIV, I know you don't like that, but it made it clear that he realized what he did, and which is a little bit different from what you said, and that he said when he came back and he saw his daughter, he tore his clothes and cried, "Oh, my daughter, you have made me miserable and wretched because I have made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break." So that, I mean, he did realize that he messed up here. Whereas before you were saying it was, you know.
He realized he messed up, but he was more concerned about his own feelings than his daughter's feelings. He wasn't a nice guy. He wasn't a nice guy at all.
Well, like you say, who did he expect to come out the door? I mean, well, it could have been his wife,
well,
too, right?
He only had one daughter, or
right.
His wife.
Right. Either way, a female.
Well, that's the very point. Either way, it's a female.
Right.
And that's what females were thought of.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. If he was so much into the Canaanite culture, he sacrificing his daughter probably was not that big a deal.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. He's making a vow before the Lord, but in essence what he's doing is making a vow before one of the Canaanite gods who the people sacrifice their children to.
And if, you know, you kind of compared it to Abraham and Isaac, but if God had intervened, then, you know, the pet goat or something would have walked out the door.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, God wasn't.
That's right. That's right. All right, that will end it. Next week we're going to start another guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.